The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Ur in Babylon, is the second of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Makon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Boruch and Chayala Sidrovitz, Alter and Sora Berman, Rabbi Yehuda and Chana Garten, and Yonah and Gittel Jonas Aleihem HaSholem of blessed memory.
In the year 1860, the American people elected a president that eventually became a national icon. His name, Abraham Lincoln. 100 years later, another president was elected, who in many respects was no less revered. His name was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. There's much literature about the parallels between these two men. They were both assassinated in office. They were both replaced with a Southern vice president. The surname of both of these replacements was Johnson, Andrew Johnson for Lincoln, Lyndon Baines Johnson for Kennedy. But amongst the many parallels, one strikes me. As it's been widely reported, Lincoln's personal secretary's name was Kennedy. Kennedy's personal secretary's name was Lincoln, Evelyn Lincoln. A mere coincidence? Or let's take another example. We all know that Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, is a national time of mourning. It was on one Tisha B'Av that the Jews were sentenced to wander for 40 years in the desert. And another Tisha B'Av, almost 900 years later, the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, was burned down. And almost 500 years again for the day, on Tisha B'Av, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. A little over 60 years after that, the fortress of Beitar, the city of Bar Kokhba, the self-proclaimed Mashiach, was destroyed. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed. And with that, the hope of an independent state was destroyed. This year, we're commemorating the 500th anniversary of the expulsion of Jews from Spain, the day that they were finally all expelled. Was again Tisha B'Av. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, formulated what probably is one of the major principles of history in this third chapter of Koheles. Ma shehoya kvar hoya. That which occurred in our recent past has already occurred in our distant past. Umashiyya kvar hoya, and that which will be already has occurred. Elokim oyev es hanirdof. As the Ibn Ezra explains, Hashem desires repetition. In a sense, these rare events are the telltale fingerprints of God's hand in history. The theme of this lecture tonight is also of recurring patterns. We're going to start with the beginning of the Jewish people, and we're going to go full circle to the destruction of the temple and their exile. If one would point to a time and place where Jewish history began, probably the most likely choice is the exodus of Avram from Ur, as you have in your handout. It says, and Terach took Avram and Lot and Sarai, and they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees, Ur Kasdim. The first communication that Hashem had to Avram, according to the Ibn Ezra, was in this place, Ur Kasdim, where Avram was told to leave and to go to Eretz Yisrael. Where was this Ur Kasdim? Where is it located? It was an ancient city. You'll see on by the conflux of the Euphrates and the Tigris near the Persian Gulf, whose name was Uru or Ur. The city is cited by Pliny. Eusebius, the church historian, mentions that the populace had a tradition that a great man by the name of Avram came from there. In the 1920s and 30s, Ur was extensively excavated. And I have on the sheets that you have, and I'd like to read some of it for you, some of the findings of that excavation from the period that is normally expected when Avram lived. And let me read this. The city of Ur has been excavated recently. We now have a rather complete picture of the conditions prevailing there at the time. Ur was one of the most ancient cities. The name means the city, Ur, Ir. It was a sacred city dedicated to the moon god. Countless other gods were worshipped, but the moon god was supreme. For his worship, a quarter of the city was set aside. A mighty ziggurat went up in three stages. The lowest, about 35 feet high, with the effect of a steep pyramid. Three brick stairways led to the top of the first stage. From there were more stairs led to the uppermost stage. It was a mountain of brickwork to which millions of bricks had gone. It was called the Hill of Heaven, or the Mountain of God. At the time of Avram, it was already very old. I just like to... next slide, please. This particular ziggurat is probably the last surviving ziggurat in what was formerly Babylon. It's located in the city of Samarra, which is 70 miles north of Baghdad. Everything needs mazel. This particular ziggurat had mazel. That when the Muslims came, when the Arabs came and took over Iraq, they built at the base of this ziggurat a gigantic mosque. And this was used as the minaret. This is the muezzins, the public criers would walk to the top and call the people to worship. So therefore, for another 1,000 years, it was well maintained. From about 250 years ago, evidently for some reason the mosque was abandoned and it fell into disuse. Now, just to give you a sense of how tall this is 160 feet tall. And this is the view of this particular from the air. The whole area was once the remnants of an ancient city. That with the walled area on the top right hand side was the modern city of Samarra. And what you see around the walled area was the area where the mosque once stood. To give you a sense of what the ziggurat was. Hundreds of little public chapels, which must have played a great part in the life of the people, were spread over the city. Besides, nearly every house had a chapel for the household gods, containing an altar with a clay terracotta reliefs of the gods. The religion of Ur was a polytheism of the grossest type. Written texts have preserved the names of about 5,000 separate Sumerian gods, or 5,000 various variant reading names of an indefinite number of Sumerian gods. Sumer, by the way, was the ancient was the name of the general area. It is understood to be what we call the first civilization. We'll speak more about it later. Above those, multiple petty gods was the city's lord and king, the moon god, the patron who did not take care of the small needs of the people. These historical facts tally very well with the tradition that Terek was a manufacturer of idols, which must have been a flourishing business at this time when everyone worshipped his own idols in his own home. General education was widespread, and this is I included this particular paragraph to give a sense of what life was like then. Though it cannot be supposed that everyone was able to read and write, a surprisingly large number could. Elementary schools were common throughout the town. The curriculum contained writing exercises, dictation, the reading of hymns, and arithmetic. The more advanced pupils worked at square and cube roots and exercises in practical geometry. And the next paragraph, this is taken from, the first is taken, it's really a synopsis of the findings of Charles Leonard Woolley, who excavated Ur. And over the period of time that he was excavating this, he wrote two books. And the second paragraph is a closer glimpse of the personal life of the family of Terek at Ur, has become possible by the excavation of middle-class houses belonging to this particular period. The houses show comfort, even luxury. Two stories high, they contained 13 or 14 rooms arranged around the central court, supplying light and air. Entering the house from the street, one came into a tiny lobby with a drain in its floor where a visitor might wash his hands and feet. The lobby led into the central court, in which opened the rooms of the first floor. There was a reception room for guests, a kitchen, a room for the servants, and the domestic chapel. On one side was a brick stair leading to the upper floor, and behind it a laboratory. On the upper floors were five rooms for the use of the family, all branching off from a wood gallery, so that one could enter any room without passing through another. For many years, the general concept of ancient life paralleled what was thought to be the whole trend of what would be called the creation epic. The father of modern geology was Charles Lyell, and he developed the doctrine which is called uniformitarianism, which held that all the changes, all the geological changes that we see, are the result of small, almost imperceptible change, that only after eons of time is serious change accomplished. Charles Darwin took that idea, geological change, and applied it to biological change. In fact, his Origin of the Species is dedicated to Charles Lyell. The same idea was applied to ancient history, that the level that we are on now today is really the result of a very long, almost imperceptible process, which started from the cavemen, the Stone Age, and By very small step did man progress, and it was a constant line of progression, so to speak. Probably the first place that this outlook was shattered was when archaeologists started digging up with the ancient cities some 4,000 years ago, and were able to read their documents. And in effect, for some almost 4,000 years, life didn't change. The level of trade, architecture, mathematics, was not very much different than life in a European town before the Industrial Revolution. And in fact, it probably almost at the lowest levels that we find a tremendous level of education. The truth is that both in the fields of geology and paleontology, there have been major changes. It is becoming now, because of the evidence itself, more acceptable not to look at as changes were done over eons of time, but actually were done in a very short period of time. That's what's called pulsated equilibrium. Because as it seems the consensus is building, even the geological and the paleontological record seems to show great bursts of progress and then nothing, as they interpret, for eons of time. The third paragraph just gives an insight of the level of civilization. Here, this is on the second page, this is the third paragraph, number three. And Danish archaeologists digging on Bering Island in the Persian Gulf found there a flush toilet constructed by the Sumerians about 4,000 years ago. Those flush toilets were not introduced again for almost 4,000 years. To give a sense of the religiosity of these people, I'd like to quote from another find. In northern Syria, in about 1962, there was discovered with the remnants of a major civilization in a town, which they eventually found was called Ebla. In 1975, they were able to dig on the level, which was at the time of Avram or prior to Avram, and were amazed at the level of civilization. I'd just like again to quote just some of the findings of Ebla. For the tablets reveal the unsuspected existence of an urbane culture that gathered some 30,000 traders, farmers, bureaucrats, artisans, an extraordinary academy of scribes in the circular walls of a great commercial city. Moreover, Ebla dominated an outlying area of perhaps 300,000 people, one of the largest populations of any ancient city-state. This is taken from Time Magazine, 1981. The discovery has closed the archaeological gap between Egypt and to the east, Sumer. In other words, that was the place. Sumer represents the civilization of the Mesopotamian area. And it goes on to describe the level of culture there and prosperity. One tablet records the warehousing of 548,500 measures of barley, enough for 18 million meals. Ebla seems to have been the first city in the Near East to supplant bartering with the use of gold and silver as currency. The complex government was headed by a king, Malek, Zamela, elected peaceably to a 7-year term, a watchdog senate, the wealthy Abu, like Av, or elders, wielded backroom power. I'd like to quote a hymn that was discovered in Ebla, which again gives us an insight of the what kind of people lived at the time of Avram. Lord of heaven and earth, the earth was not, you created it. The light of the day was not, you created it. The morning light you had not yet made exist. It sounds something like Shlomo ibn Gabriel, but it was written by a group of people that are long extinct, who lived at the time of Avram. But was Ur Kasdim that the Torah refers to, that city that existed at the time of Avram? And at the end, I'd like to quote If you turn to page 3, this is taken from Rashi and Chumash. This is based on the Medrash. Because of his father, Horon, this is the brother of Avram, died. Terach complained about Avram, his son, to Nimrod, who was the king of Babylon, because he destroyed his idols. After this, Terach was in the idol business. Whereupon he threw him inside a fiery furnace. And Horon sat and thought, if Avram wins, I'll be with him. Thus when Avram was saved, and this relates to the miracle, that he refused to give up his beliefs in monotheism, he was thrown into this fire. And when he was saved, and this is the miracle of Ur Kasdim, Horon was asked, with whom are you? Whereupon he answered, with Avram. Thereupon, says, they thrust him inside the fiery furnace, and he was burned. This is Ur Kasdim. And Menachem explains, this is one of the great Medaklikim, that the translation of the word Ur means valley. Ur, according to Rashi, is not the name of a city. It's a depression in the earth. It was the place where the furnace was. The furnace was a subterranean pit. As it says in Yeshayahu, in his quotes, he goes on, says, in any hole or deep valley is called Ur. This, by the way, is also the opinion of the Ramban, who maintains that the word Ur, he takes issue with Rashi, does not mean a depression, the place of the pit, but rather it means the Aramaic for fire. Ur in Aramaic means fire. And Ur Kasdim, then, is not the name of a city, which may have well existed at the time of Avram, but rather it relates to the experience of the miracle. And that's why such emphasis is placed on Ur Kasdim. When Hashem originally speaks to Avram to promise him the land and to make a covenant, this is the Bris Ben Absorim, he starts off with the phrase, I am Hashem who took you out of Ur Kasdim, which is understood to parallel the idea that we say in our prayers, that I am Hashem who took you out of Mitzrayim. Where was this Ur Kasdim of Chazal located if it isn't the city that we call Ur? So on page 3 of a quote of Gemara in Bava Basra and Sadi Aleph, and it gives us another insight in the life of Avram. Rav Chonan bar Rava said in the name of Rav, Avram Avinu was imprisoned for 10 years. He wasn't just summarily thrown into the furnace. He was first kept in prison. 3 years in Kusa and 7 in Kurdistan. Rav Chisda said that Ibra Zeira, an area adjacent to the city of Kusa, was Ur Kasdim. According to this, then, the beginning of Jewish history started in the city of Kusa. Where Kusa is located is a subject of debate. Modern scholars place Kusa very close to the ancient city of Babylon. The Ramban places it closer to the city of Horon, the first place where Avram went to after he left Ur Kasdim. As we're going to show, this area of Kusa plays a prominent role in future Jewish history. And this is part 2. As you see from the quote, we're not going to quote the whole thing, the Samaritans and Kuthians. Last week, we went into detail about the fate of the 10 lost tribes. They originally lived in this area called Yisroel. When the Assyrians captured Yisroel, the northern kingdom, exiled the populace, they did what was common policy then, took other of their subjects and repopulated the area. And this is the quote here: "And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from Cutha, from Ava, from Homos, from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria, and they dwelt in the cities thereof." And it goes on to describe a very interesting incident. That when they had already settled in the land, these people, that were pagans, experienced a massive plague of lions, or wild lions, who came and attacked the populace, killed them, and it seems, without eating them, it was just a very freak occurrence. And as it was becoming a terrible problem, they appealed to the king of Assyria for help. The king of Assyria, and we have another account of this in the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is part B. The king of Assyria then asked the Jews, the former occupants of the land, you never had this problem before. What's the cause of this problem? Whereupon they answered, and it seems how the Medrash explains that they formulated the answer with in mind that perhaps the king would take these people out of the land, was that the god of that country abhors idol worship. And as long as they continue in their ways, people cannot survive in the land. It seems from this Medrash, by the way, and as the Radal Rav David Luria explains, that because so much of the population was decimated, it seems the majority of the survivors were those that came from Cutha. Hence, in Talmudic literature, these people who came from all these various areas are called Cusim. Two scholars were sent. Evidently, there was a Kohen who was in charge of a whole staff. There were two major teachers, and they were sent to educate the populace. These people eventually embraced Judaism. There's a question in the Talmud that say, between various scholars, whether that conversion under fire, so to speak, the reason that they were prompted to convert because of the lions, because of the factor, as it says in the quote before, that even though they originally embraced Judaism, there was still latent idol worship. According to the Ritva, they backslided. They originally accepted Judaism because of the fear of this plague of lions. Later on, they again began the worship of idols. But there's a question: was that conversion really sincere? And are these people truly Jews? The halacha is, the consensus is that these people are truly Jews. The conversion is valid. But because of other factors, because these people through the years did not accept the Torah Sheval Peh, even though it was probably taught to them originally by the first scholars, by the fact that there was in the time of the Mishnah, around the year 150 of the Common Era, 200 of the Common Era, there began a cult amongst these Samaritans of idol worship again. And this you'll find on what? Yeah. On the back of your notes, I printed a timeline. As you'll see, the timeline begins with Avram's exodus from Ur Kasdim. The dates that we've chosen here are the traditional dating system. In subsequent lectures, we're going to deal with alternate dating systems. And if you see on the line below, the second thing is the exile of the 10 tribes. Shortly after the exile of the 10 tribes, These 10 tribes were replaced by the Kuthians, the Kusim. On page 5, because of the problem on the bottom, because of the problem of assimilation amongst the Kusim, eventually they were given the status rabbinically of Gentiles. They're truly Jews, but we were legislated to treat these people in all manners as if they would be Gentiles, in order that they shouldn't have any influence on the corpus of Jewry. To this day, these people survive, by the way. There are in existence now approximately 500 Samaritans. There's 250 live near Tel Aviv and Holon, and 250 live in the live near Shechem, Nablus. This is a picture of their high priest. They have a Kohen Gadol. And next to it is a Sefer Torah. You can't see it from this picture, but the writing on this Sefer Torah is not our writing. This is the ancient Phoenician script. This was the writing, as if you'll notice in the page back, on page 5 in the second in the second paragraph. The two rabbis taught them the Torah, the middle second paragraph, in the common, meaning Phoenician script. That was the script that they studied. And this original, this is with a copy, basically, of the original Torah that they were taught. There were slight changes through time that the Samaritan Sefer Torah has that's not found in the Masoretic version, our version. And this is this is really the work of much scholarship about the what we call the few instances of discrepancies between them. To this day, they go on Mount Gerizim, which to them is the holy mountain, and offer the Paschal lamb. They have a Pesach, they have a Korban Pesach. I wasn't able to get pictures of the actual slaughter of the lamb. But this right now is a prayer service on Har Gerizim. And here is the Kohen Gadol lifting up their Sefer Torah amongst the mass of the faithful. Recently, about 10 years ago, Scientific American had an extensive article about the Samaritans. The reason being that it's a since they no longer admit converts and they do not intermarry with Jews, it's an ideal place of study for the inbreeding of what would be of genetic defects. And there is a common eye disease that they have. I don't know if you can tell the Kohen Gadol's wearing glasses, but there's a common eye disease that that they have, which is the which is a subject of much study. It's just interesting to note that Avram's Odyssey began with Kutha. That's where he started, in Kusa. The first place that he came to in Eretz Yisrael was in Shechem. And from there, he went to Elon Mora, which is the place of Har Gerizim. It's interesting to note that that very same exodus was taken by a group of people. Avram was the first convert. We would say that the an equivalent group of converts who went through Avram's journey and landed in the same place. I think it's quite remarkable. They live today, by the way, in Shechem, and Elon Mora in Har Gerizim is their place of worship. Before we go on to the Babylonian exile, I'd like to touch a common area between these Kusim, the Samaritans, and the subject of the last lecture, the Bethi Yisroel, the Ethiopian community. Now, on page 6 of paragraph E, there's a question about the status of these kusim. Rabbi Elazar's opinion is that if a kusi is really not allowed even by law, no, they're not asking the shaila, but they're not allowed by law to marry another one. Rabbi Elazar's opinion is that one who is a doubtful mamzer, in other words, the person who comes out of a marriage which is a result of adultery or incest, cannot marry another questionable mamzer. And he maintains that the kusim have a status of questionable mamzerim. And there's a whole discussion, this is a Gemara in Kedushin, Ayin Hey and Ayin Vav, what is the basis of Rabbi Elazar's opinion. One of the many considerations that are offered is the possibility that since the kusim, at least in later day, were not very careful exact in the performance of mitzvahs, could very well be that even though their kedushin, their marriage ceremony, would be valid, but the divorce ceremony, the get, would be problematic. And then very often, it would be not valid. Therefore, a woman using such a get to remarry would be actually technically been committing adultery, and the child of such a union would be considered a mamzer. In practical terms, it doesn't mean much for us. Since they've been declared as to treat them as if they would be Gentiles, there's not much of a problem of intermarriage between the kusim and the corpus of jewry. But this principle, though, was used on another group, another sect, which today there are very few left also. And this is the Karoyim, the Karaites. In the 7th century of the Common Era, there was a sect that developed that at one time had hundreds of thousands of adherents, perhaps millions. And these were the Karoyim who denied the validity of the oral law. And again, the whole idea of oral law we will discuss in another lecture. But needless to say, because they did not accept the oral law, and their divorces were not valid in the eyes of the oral law, you would have the same problem with these people as you had with the kusim. The problem, the possibility that there are people amongst them that are the result of a union of technical adultery. And on that basis, this is paragraph F on page 6. I quoted the Evan Ezer, this is in the Shulchan Aruch, the laws of marriages, the Karoyim are forbidden to intermarry with the Jewish community since they are all considered questionable mamzerim. We therefore not accept them, says, even if they want to recant, but we have this problem of intermarriage with them. The Bir HaGro, the Vilner Gaon, cites the source of this halacha is the previous citation of the Gemara in Kedushin. The problem of intermarriage with Karoyim is it's a very small community. It's basically a moot point now. But has been brought up again as regards the Beth Yisrael, the Falashans. They do not perform a divorce as is known in Halacha, even as the Karoyim know it. It's rare, but when it does happen, the husband and wife stand before the community as a whole and declare that the marriage is no longer valid. At that point, she's free to marry anyone. There's no divorce document. In the eyes of Halacha, they're still married. If the Beit Yisrael are truly Jews, which is a question which we devoted part of our lecture to last time, we have an additional problem about their status of marrying other Jews. So it's interesting that all this history comes to play in terms of the problems of modern life. I'd like now just to briefly describe the events led to the Babylonian exile. The picture that you see and we're going to discuss this later is a reconstruction of some of ancient Babylon. This ziggurat that you see here, which was supposed to be 650 feet tall. The walls around Bovo, by the way, were 300 feet tall and were 60 miles in perimeter. Ancient Babylon, the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar, was supposed to have been the remnant or the addition to that original tower, which was the famed Tower of Babel. By the way, just, you know, just trivia, the Torah describes that the name of Bovel, or the reason it was given its name, because it alludes to the fact that Hashem was Bolal, that he mixed the languages. The Babylonians, though, have a different reason why they call it Bovel. It's Bab Elu. It's the gate of Hashem. As you see in... we turn to page 7. In the third reign, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And from that point on, Yehuda was no longer an independent state. According to the Talmud, this was in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. 7 years later, he came back after a revolt by Jehoiakim. And he went, this is a description here. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Yehuda, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of Hashem, which he carried to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. He took many of the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and brought them to Babylon. And also he took what would be called the choicest, the best of Jewish youth. And he wanted to raise them as Babylonians, to teach them the language, to ensure that these people would eventually would lead the infrastructure of a new Babylonian Yehuda. And after he took Jehoiakim, and Jehoiakim subsequently died, he installed Jehoiakim's son Jehoiakim in his place. And that only lasted 3 months. He had a change of heart in Nebuchadnezzar. He felt the Jews are too... this plan is not going to work on its own. And he went back. Again, he captured... he surrounded Jerusalem. At that point, Jehoiakim decided it's not worth the fight. He went out on his own and gave up. And what the king did was he literally decimated the land. He took the leadership, he took the academicians, the scholars, and he brought them by force to Babel. And what was left was a mere shadow of what was Jerusalem, what was Yehuda. Finally, some 11 years later, after the shadow government was installed, headed by Tzidkiyahu. And Tzidkiyahu decided not to be a vassal of the Babylonians. He entered in with a pact with the Egyptians. Nebuchadnezzar came back with a vengeance, burned down the Beis HaMikdash, killed the whole royal family, put out Tzidkiyahu's eyes, killed the Kohen Gadol, and brought back all of just 800 people back to Babel. And as after laying siege, he first went to attack Zasor Batavis, the 10th the 10th day of the Hebrew month of Teves. He attacked, laid siege. They finally broke in on the 9th day of the Hebrew month of Tammuz. Originally, the fast day of Tammuz was on the 9th of Tammuz. In the second Beis HaMikdash, it occurred on the 17th day of Tammuz. So that's why we fast on Shivosar B'Tammuz on the 17th of Tammuz, not on the 9th of Tammuz. The original fast day, though, was on the 9th of Tammuz. And he finally broke into the wall, and after they eventually took over and crushed all opposition, the temple was burned on the 9th of Av. But even though all he took with him was just some 800 people, and the figures are in the notes here, he left over even a small remnant of Jewry with their leader, Gedaliah ben Achikam. So the king was taken, there was no longer a king, there was no longer a quasi-independent Judea, it wasn't a vassal state, it was merely a province of Babylon, but it had a Jewish governor. I just want you to just understand what the figures are. On paragraph H of page 8, there was a census made in the beginning of the monarchy. Over 400 years before these events, the total of people who were able to bear arms, and those of age and ability to be enlisted in the army, from Yisrael, the northern part, was over a million. And from Yehuda was over 400,000. But after the wars with the Babylonians, the population, which in all probability had grown since over a period of 400 years, was decimated to the extent that all of the sum total of all the exiles was just a little over 10,000. This isn't what the Churban was. If we speak about the Churban, we speak about the Holocaust. Just the sense of the numbers of what happened. In all probability, we have well over a million people, perhaps 2 million people, who lost their lives. And all that was left of Jewry was some 10,000. I mean, just the numbers are amazing. But when this last remnant, these 800 people, they were totally impoverished, and they were led, it's just interesting to note, that even though the temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av, this is around August time, the people, the captives, did not make their way back to Babylon until Teves, in December, January. In other words, these people that were that were broken of spirit, that had absolutely nothing, were just taken from place to place until finally they made their way back to Babylon. And I'd like just to refer you back to page 6. About the importance of why Babylon was chosen. There's a Gemara in Psochem, this is in part 3, paragraph A. There's a Gemara in Pezino and Bez in Psochem. That one of the reasons mentioned that Babylon was chosen was because the language was so similar to the language of the Torah. Rabbi Yochanan, though, says that they were sent back to Babylon is because that's where they came from. Or caused them within that general area. We came there, we just went back home. And it's interesting to note that because there were two previous exiles, the exile would be the fruit of Jewry, these young men who made their way into the court of Nebuchadnezzar. This is Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Were people already of stature when the final exiles came? So there was a sympathetic voice in government to treat the plight of these people. And by the way, yeshivas had already been established. It would be the second wave. We call it the Cheresh U'Mazger. Of the exiles of Yehoyachin, this is the exile that occurred 3 months after the youth exile. The greatest Rosh Yeshivas, Talmid HaChachamim, these are academicians of their scholars, came to Bovel, created yeshivas. The yeshivas these people created lasted almost 1,500 years and was a resource for Jewry during this whole period of time. In fact, there's a Gemara in Sukkah and Chof Amud Aleph that explains that in times when there was a lapse of quality, so to speak, of scholarship in Eretz Yisrael, scholars from Bovel, from their yeshivas, went to replenish and to infuse a new spirit into the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. Hillel, the famous Hillel, the founder of the dynasty of Nisim, the heads of the Sanhedrin, came from Bovel. Rabbi Chia and his sons Chizki and Mrs. Yehuda came from Bovel. Hanina came from Bovel. There was a constant infusion during the whole period of time of Babylonians. As we said, that the Daniel, who eventually rose very high, and we're going to won't have time tonight, but we'll describe in great detail Daniel's role, was able to prevail upon Nebuchadnezzar, and this is on page 9, paragraph J. And let me quote, this is a Rashi in Soitan Chofala. So did Nebuchadnezzar do. He gathered daily the Jewish poor that he brought into exile and were in need of food and supplied them. This Daniel had in mind when he gave Nebuchadnezzar advice. Nebuchadnezzar had a terrible dream that he would revert to an animal, which he eventually did. In other words, he just lost his mind totally. And Daniel gave him advice, at least to delay what would be the prophecy of this dream, that if he gives to the poor, the merit of that mitzvah would put him in good stead. And this is when he gave him advice, because he saw the exiles going door to door for food. So in a sense, Hashem created, when we said the refuah koidim lamaka, is by putting in place, under better conditions, those people that would be well disposed to help their brethren. I'll just give you a sense of what has happened to Bovel. It looked pretty good before. This is how it looks today. This is after it's been dug up, by the way. And just to give you the thing, this is the height. This is an Arab stand, just the sense of the height. Again, this is just a small measure of the ruins of this tremendous area. It was a perimeter of 60 miles. I'd like to touch upon two things. One, just briefly, is on page 9 about Jewish martyrdom. That the act that gave the Jews legitimacy in the eyes of the Babylonians, treated them with respect, and from that time on, the exile will be the best of a bad situation, came about by the refusal of three of Nebuchadnezzar's personal of his entourage, his ministry. This is Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, and the story in detail which I've taken, it's taken from the third chapter of the book of Daniel, the scribes of Nebuchadnezzar erected a massive statue. And it seems, at least from many commentaries, it was really a source of real idol worship. There's Rabbeinu Tam's opinion, there's an alternate opinion that it was just a form of adoration, not true, bordering perhaps on idol worship, not real idol worship. But the consensus seems to be it was truly an idol. And representatives of every national group were present at the unveiling of this idol. And these three Jewish ministers were also there. These through of his entourage, would be the equivalent of members of the State Department. And they refused to bow down. There's an interesting question in the Medrash if they were the only Jews present. And there's a question of the Kiddush Hashem and others sacrificing the sanctity of God's name in the presence of a minion of other Jews, Mikdash Yusech B'nai Yisrael, if there truly were 10 other Jews there, or they were the only Jews. There's two opinions. There's one opinion, there were 23 representatives from every ethnic group. The 20 Jews bowed down, these three refused to bow down. There's another opinion, of course, that they were the only. But they, in any case, whatever it was, they refused to bow down. They were thrown into a fiery furnace. They survived. And, the details are in the handout that you have. What's interesting to note, though, is that the angel that saved these three tzaddikim, was Gabriel. And the Gemara in Pesachim Kuf Yud Ches Amud Aleph is a fascinating story with a link between, as we started, the fiery furnace of Ur, where Avram started, where Jewish history started, and his martyrdom, his refusal to bow down. And the events of the martyrdom, right, of Hanani, Mishael v'Azariah. When Avram went into the furnace, the Gemara says that Gabriel went and asked of Hashem that he wants to save this individual. And Hashem said, I am the only power on earth. He's the only true human being on earth. It's only fitting that I personally save him. But Gabriel had his day. And later on, over 1,000 years later, you see in the timeline, when these three were thrown into the fiery furnace, would be the first historical Jewish show of martyrdom. Gabriel was there to save them. It all started in the fiery furnace. And this is where, in a sense, this era of Jewish history comes to an end, close to Ur Kasdim, in Babylon, in the fiery furnace. I would just like, just for, you know, for just 2 minutes, and then we'll take a few questions from the floor. I allude on page 9 to the exile to Spain. If you see, it's on part 4, paragraph A, on page 9. In the captivity of this host of the children of Israel under the Canaanites, reaching until Sarfas, France, the captivity of Yerushalayim, which is in Svora, in Spain, shall possess the cities of the south. Ovadia, the prophet, is referring to the eventual destruction of Edom. The pasuk that follows this is Vol Moshiach, this is Mahar Tzion, that we say in davening every day. Jews will eventually live in, so the Jews of Spain will come and conquer the south of Israel. The Abarbanel tells a fascinating story of where these Jews of Spain originally came from. And he describes a Greek, Archelaus, who eventually conquered Spain, who conquered Spain, or at least part of Spain, went back after his conquest of Spain to participate in the conquest of the city of Troy, left his nephew, Spania, to take care of the government. And this is hence the source of the term Spain, comes from his nephew. And he in turn had a son by the name of Paris, no relation to Paris of Troy, who, when Nebuchadnezzar came to destroy the temple, was a vassal of Nebuchadnezzar. Josephus, in his work Antiquities, brings the Nebuchadnezzar's empire spread to Iberia, to Spain. And he took, when Nebuchadnezzar was taking captives back to Babylon, he took a number of captives back to Spain. And this was the first settlement of Jews in Spain. And they settled in the south of Spain. He said there's a city in the south of Spain, Lucena, which Abarbanel claims is named after the city of Luz in Eretz Yisrael. A bit north, they settled in a city called Tulatula, which is Tuleda, which he explains is based on the idea of Tiltul, the Aramaic phrase for movement, for exile, to Tula de Gavra. And that's hence the names of the city came about because of their Jewish inhabitants. Later on, when the second temple was destroyed and more exiles came, they already found a flourishing Jewish community. I'd just like to end with just a very interesting comment of the Abarbanel and his commentary on the book of Avadya, where Abarbanel had a personal problem. When he wrote his commentary, he already was out of Spain. This is after the expulsion. The only Jews left in Spain were apostate Jews. They're no longer practicing Judaism. And it was, where are those Jews from Spain going to come out of? No Jews left in Spain. And he has a very novel novel solution. And he says, one day these people are Jews. Even though they're practicing Catholics, they're Jews. One day they or their descendants will do tshuva and come back to Jewry. And one wonders then, the Franco, the dictator of Spain, who, even though he was an ally of Nazi Germany, let Jews save themselves going through Spain, explained his position, is that if you'd have to ferret out Jews, says there wouldn't be any Spaniards left. Every Spaniard has Jewish blood. And in fact, it was said that Franco himself knew, I guess, that he had Jewish blood. One wonders how many Jews there really are in Spain, or in France for that matter, through all the enforced conversions. So it really, it's an intriguing question. So Mashiach comes, how many Goyim will come back home? Okay, are there any questions?
Two questions. Do the Samaritans themselves consider themselves as Jews?
A very interesting question. The question was, do the Samaritans consider themselves as Jews? Josephus brings various incidents in history that when it was to their advantage, the Samaritans claimed they're really not Jews. And when it was their advantage to claim themselves as Jews, they claimed themselves as Jews. Today, the Samaritans claim they are Jews. They are really descendants of the 10 tribes. However, I would like to point out, on page 5, on this paragraph C, this is taken from the annals of Sargon, which according to historical records was the king who finally conquered the Yisrael, the northern kingdom, and sent them into exile. Shalmaneser began the siege before he was able to finally conquer Yisrael, Samaria. He died. And Sargon, who became, probably from our records, probably the most glorious of the Assyrian kings, was the one who finished the conquest. This is a quote from Sargon himself. This is paragraph C. At the beginning of my reign in my first year, Samaria I besieged. I captured 27,290 people, which is indicative of the survivors. As we said before, there was a census that was taken at the time of David HaMelech, that there was well over a million men able to bear arms in Yisrael. Of that, after those who had been previously exiled and those who survived the siege, it was a three-year siege, you know, and no food or water was allowed in, so basically you're dealing with those who are just decimated. All that was left was just some 27,000 people. From its midst I carried captives, 50 chariots I took there as an addition to my royal force. I returned and made more than formerly to dwell. Notice he brought in people from other areas to replace them. People from lands which my hands had captured, I settled in the midst. My officers over them as governors, I appointed tributes and taxes I imposed upon them after the Assyrian manner. The record, besides Tanakh, which really doesn't need much verification, but even the Assyrian records attest that these people are truly not Jews, but really only descendants of these captives.
So it's probable. How does such a small populace survive the generations? And what does that tell us about the importance of such a populace?
What do you mean?
As far as being clustered or not. I mean, how does 500 people survive generations? You figure 500 people who are not intermarrying would eventually disappear. That's such a small number.
They are disappearing. This is what you're seeing is the process of disappearance.
But after all these generations, it would seem to me that...
This is a decimated population. They had many more. They had hundreds or millions of people at one time. What you see now is really just, it's a shadow of what was once a very powerful kingdom.
Say that Kishmiyahu was... The brother of Nebuchadnezzar.
No. Well, maybe there was a typo.
What do you say? The king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother.
The pronoun he is referring to Yechoniah, the previous king. And he took the previous king's uncle and placed him on the throne.
Mattaniah.
Yeah. That is Sitkio's original name.
Well,
and he changed
it. Like it was Nebuchadnezzar's brother.
No.
The way it reads
here. So that's the...
The father's brother of
Yechoniah. Yochan. Yechoniah. Yeah.
But
that is the opinion of Rabbeinu. We brought that before. The opinion of Rabbeinu Tam is that it truly was not. It bordered on, or would be confused. It could be confused with idol worship. It wasn't truly idol worship, but that is not. For many of the Midrashim, it seems that truly it was idol worship. Just as one example, says there's a Gemara, Megillah, in Yud Beis that explains why was it that the Jews were condemned to almost death at the Purim, story, and it was because they worshipped the idol. Evidently, it was something that was not allowed, and it was something that they had no excuse for. if they would have been put to death and it would just merely have been a just a statue, there wouldn't have been really any problem for them. So there are many problems with that opinion. So that and the simple reading of the text of the Midrashim seems to indicate that truly it was an idol. Yes. So, well, this will be the last public question. What? Yeah, the study, the Samaritans are really a study in themselves. They came under different influences during the various, during various eras, and their beliefs actually did undergo some changes, and it's all documented. But it's a subject all of its own.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.